It's been since your last book was A Taste for Death.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, what, 3 years ago?
It's 3 years, well, it was, yes, published 3 years ago.
Wow.
I was 86.
Time really flies, doesn't it?
It's astonishing. Where have those 3 years gone? I don't know.
Well, the last time we spoke, I remember lamenting to you. I said, gee, before time passes and I get too much older, I've got to write my own book. And you said, well, you have plenty of time. You're still a young man. I remember that from the tape.
Yes.
And I...
You're still a young man, Don.
Not really.
But you're 3 years older.
That's true. That's true. Yeah. But I also published a book.
Good.
It was a mystery book centered around H.L. Mencken, published by St. Martin's Press. But it is not up to your standards, but it was a fledgling effort.
Well, you're going to go on, aren't you?
Try.
Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about your book. That's why you're here. And tell me about what Adam Dalgliesh is up to in Devices and Desires.
Well, he's a great deal more cheerful than he was in Devices and Desires, partly, I think, because he's published a very successful book of poems, and he's escaping from the publicity to a converted windmill on the east coast of England. And, of course, he's able to escape from publicity and is able to have a respite from the work at the yard. But what he never escapes from is murder. And there are two kinds of murder, I'm afraid, on the headland. There's a serial murderer at work who murders women in a particularly horrible way. And the book opens with, I think it's his fourth victim, a 15-year-old girl. And then there is another victim. And she works at an atomic power station. And in fact, the action of this book is dominated by Larksoken Atomic Power Station.
Headland. What exactly is a headland?
Yes, I noticed this as an unusual word. Would you say a promontory here? Would you? Land jutting out into the sea. What would you call
what
that?
What would you call it?
A peninsula.
A peninsula.
Yes, I think we would use peninsula for a rather narrow stretch of land jutting into the sea. A headland is a much wider one, but it would be a peninsula.
Well, we knew what it meant. I mean, we can figure
yes.
it out. But you never changed the British vocabulary at all for the American audience, do you?
No, I'm rather pleased about this. I suppose this is partly a decision of my American publisher. I think it's a shame to change too much. There are words you simply have to change, because it's not only that, not that the Americans wouldn't understand it, but that the meaning is absolutely the opposite. I remember in one book, you know, they had a crying baby, and what you call a pacifier, we call a dummy. Well, you know, it said the mother stuck a dummy into her mouth. And I mean, you know, exactly. So that had to be changed to pacifier. But on the whole, I think it is a pity to change too much. I know when I read American mysteries, when I read Chandler, I don't really want it to anglicized. I mean, I love the sense that I'm in California, that I'm in America, and this is an American writer writing.
Yeah, I agree with you. And besides the, in their context, even people who don't know the British idiom can always figure it out.
I think they can. Yes. Someone said to me, what's an aga? There's a stove there called an aga, an A-G-A. And that was rather mysterious to some Americans. But then I met another who said, yes, in fact, they were made here and she had such a stove, so one can never tell.
Now tell me about the countryside where you set Devices and Desires.
Well, it's a lonely stretch of coast. There are windmills there, and of course there's a lovely contrast between the wind as a source of power, and this terrifying new source of power, the power station. There are old, decaying medieval abbeys, and the fortifications from the last war, pillboxes and great chunks of concrete breaking up on the shore. So I loved the sense of time passing, all the centuries passing, on this lonely stretch of coast.
Mm. Do you travel there a lot?
Well, yes, I know it fairly well, but of course, once I decided to set the book there, I went back several times to make notes. I always do this, and to get the sense of the place.
Is there a nuclear power station there?
Yes, there is on that coast. It's at Sizewell in Suffolk, but I moved the action north to the next county because, obviously, it wouldn't have been very wise to have a power station and all the people working in the power station on a stretch of coast where there is one. You might have difficulty of people thinking they've been liable. But so it's an imaginary power station on an imaginary stretch of coast. But I went to Sizewell and to one other power station when I was researching it.
Power stations are so ugly. They're almost like a blight in the landscape, aren't they?
Well, in a way, yes, that's true, Don. And yet when they're very isolated, and they often are, and Sizewell is, and you see it, you know, stark against the sky on a remote headland, I wouldn't say it's got exactly grandeur, but there's something, I don't know, exciting, frightening. It's a great symbol, I think. And when I was there in the turbine room, the immensity of the place is astonishing, and yet it seems so empty. It needs so, I mean, there are hundreds of staff there, but you never seem to see them. It's very strange.
Kind of like a radio station in New York.
Like that,
well, is there a great debate about the nuclear power in England, as there is here?
Oh, yes, there is. Indeed, there is. And, of course, I reflect that a bit in the book. Although it's not a didactic book, it is not a book about the pros and cons of atomic power. It is a murder mystery. But, obviously, the characters in the book are concerned, and they articulate some of the concerns, I think, that people feel. I suppose, really, that the issues are much the same. We know we can't go on burning fossil fuel without dreadful harm to the ozone layer. And yet, of course, we are all very terrified that this is not a safe alternative. Particularly, how are we going to dispose of the nuclear waste?
Now, you work in a group of terrorists in your new book. I read Doris Lessing's book, The Good Terrorist, some years ago.
Yes.
Fascinating. Did you read the book?
Yes, I did.
Fascinating
yes.
book.
Yes.
Because the terrorists are a little different from the terrorists here in New York. But terrorism is not really an ongoing problem outside of the Irish Republican Army, is it, in England?
Oh, no. No, it's associated in England only with the IRA. But I think it's a great world problem. I mean, it may at the moment be exercising our minds less than the damage, you know, to the environment is. But it is always there. And there are groups of people, I feel, all over the world who see the way to power and the way to getting what they want by acts of dreadful terrorism. It must be so done because look at the security measures before we can get on an aeroplane.
Yes, just thinking about that terrible crash in Scotland. It's just awful.
Appalling. Awful. That people can do that to people they don't even know, people who are not concerned with their cause.
Now, Adam, he's inherited quite a bit of money, hasn't he, from his aunt?
Yes, his aunt. She appeared in, was it the second or third book I wrote, living still on that coast, but not in a converted windmill. She moved to a converted windmill and then died. She was a very old lady, and she's left him $750,000, which is a very nice little windfall, isn't it?
Well, after helping to solve the crimes in this particular book, we're kind of left up in the air. It seems to me that Adam could easily retire now and just go to the windmill and write poetry.
Well, indeed he could, and he does wonder in the book whether that's what his aunt was saying to him. No, it's time you made up your mind. You know, which are you going to do? Now I've left you enough money to make the choice easier.
Are you going to make a decision for us about that in a future book?
Yes, I don't know. Who knows? I mean, if I don't write another Adam Dalgliesh, everyone will know that he's retired to write poetry. But I have a feeling there will be another Adam Dalgliesh somehow.
I have a feeling there'll be another Adam Dalgliesh. Mm. Of course, he could be a retired detective writing poetry in a windmill.
Well,
who
yes,
was called upon and solved crimes.
Called upon, it'd be a new kind of amateur, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
But I doubt whether he'd do that. And of course, you know, back home, I don't think he would be welcome. I think people would take the view, the official police, you know, look, you're either in, mate, or you're out. But if you're out, we don't want you interfering in our cases.
Dalgliesh is a Scottish name.
Yes, it is. Yes, I named him Dalgliesh because that was the name of my English teacher at school. She was a Miss Maisie Dalgliesh. And, you know, I must have known as a girl that she was Scottish. And yet it seemed not, you know, to dawn on me that I was creating a Scottish detective. And, in fact, I haven't made him Scottish. So I think his family must have come south many generations before. But it certainly is a Scottish name.
Mm, I thought all Scots were named Mackenzie.
Oh, no, there are lots of Macs. I've got a Scottish son-in-law. He is a MacLeod. But Dalgliesh is not. It's the family name of the Earls of Dalkeith. So it's
a
very old Scottish name.
Little historical background on how you created Adam Dalgliesh.
Well, when I wrote my first book, and it was, of course, a mystery, I had to make the decision whether to begin with an amateur or a professional, and I thought the book would be more realistic if I had a professional. And that meant a man in those days, because there were not very many women who were detectives, or at least weren't senior detectives in the Met. So I had a man, I wanted him, you know, to be courageous but not foolhardy. I wanted him to be a good professional cop. I didn't want him to be sentimental, but I wanted him to be compassionate. And I wanted him to have some artistic interest. I wanted him to be complex and sensitive, so I thought, I'll make him a poet. I mean, I didn't make him a musician because I don't know enough about music to make it credible. And I didn't make him an artist because I couldn't quite see him, you know, carting his palette and his easel along with him. I made him a poet. I thought that I'm not a poet myself, but I think I understand the poetic imagination and I could make that credible. And then over the books, you know, he has developed. And I think in particular, he's become much more aware of the moral ambiguities in his job, the harm that an official investigation can do to the innocent.
What do you mean by that?
Well, there are no privacies left on, you see. You think of yourself as an innocent suspect. Everything about your life. I mean, suppose any of us are in a situation where through ill luck, we are a prime suspect for a murder. We know we're innocent. We didn't do it. Every day the police there, new lines of questioning, new probing into our marriages, our love life, our financial situation. It must seem a most dreadful imposition to somebody who is innocent. And all sorts of facts come out. People have to face the truth about themselves in sometimes very difficult ways. And in this book, of course, Dalgliesh, who finds the body and who is not the investigating officer, he can't be because it's out of London, he finds the body and he's questioned. When did you leave the windmill? Why did you go for this walk by the sea? You know, you stumbled over this body. Did you touch it? And he doesn't like it. And the book says he realizes for the first time how ill-received some of his questions have been by suspects.
You know, in the United States, we have a lot of murder. There's a lot of drug-related murder.
Yes.
But in terms of journalism, journalists such as myself, we're looking for good murders.
You're quite right. There are good murders, and
yes,
there are uninteresting murders.
Good murders, but we have sensational murder trials and things like that.
Yes. And often when there's some element of doubt about them, really. What is it makes a good murder? Is it the element of doubt? Is it the motive, which seems inexplicable, as it does in the Stuart murder in Boston? Is it the sense that it's amazing human beings can behave like this? I wonder what it is. Is it the ingenuity of the crime?
I think it's the people. I think the people hold a fascination because a poverty-stricken, homeless drug addict who
yes.
created a murder is not an interesting person. It's a symptom of the problems that we have in our society.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right. People, this relates to a criticism that is sometimes made of the mystery. When people say, well, look, it is a snobbish form. You're always dealing with middle class or upper middle class suspects. You know, this isn't real life. But the point is that if you had a murder mystery set in a community where murder was commonplace, you know, drug dealing is commonplace, violence is commonplace, it isn't particularly interesting. You do need to have a rational, intelligent murderer so that the reader and the detective can pit their wits against him. And this inevitably tends to mean that you deal with in an ordered society, probably quite a prosperous society, where you get the contrast between the horror of the deed and the apparent, you know, peace, orderliness, prosperity of the world in which it takes place.
Yes, there's that kind of murder. There is the brutal, animal-like spontaneous murder, but there's also another kind of murder which you touch on in Devices and Desires, and that's the serial murder, which is really interesting, isn't it?
It's interesting. It's interesting and it's terrifying. And, of course, one of the interesting aspects is how little we know about it. The policeman in this book talks about serial murders in England that we've got, as he says, banged up in prison. He says, we don't execute them now. We put them in prison. And we say we may be able to learn from them, but we don't learn. We don't know. And it's interesting to me that in all the serial murderers we've had back home, they've had disturbed childhoods, unhappy childhoods. Sometimes they've lost people close to them at an early age. But, I mean, that happens to millions of human beings. And they don't go off and become mass murderers. I don't think we know, do we, what determines whether an unhappy child is going to grow up into a mass murderer or just going to grow up into a fairly ordinary human being.
No, it's very strange.
It's totally mysterious.
There was a very interesting mass murder in England that Joseph Wambaugh wrote about. That was the one in which DNA testing was first developed.
Yes, it was interesting.
I understand that I was reading 2 weeks ago in the New York Times that DNA testing now is suspect.
I saw that, yes. I haven't sort of read it in great detail, Don. And in fact, if I need to, before I write another book, I'll have to try and find out the truth about this. I just read the headline that apparently now there is some at least slight doubt about it.
It's more than slight. The same laboratories are getting directly contradictory evidence. They'll make a test, and it's refuted by a second test or by a second laboratory. And so there is a lot of bafflement or puzzlement. It could be, however, if I read correctly, that this is such a new science that they're not testing exactly right.
No, the fault, in other words, maybe we can use the word fault in the laboratory rather than in the science of the actual concept. What is interesting, isn't it, how that nobody has ever been able to fault fingerprints as a method of identification. And this has always fascinated me, that of all the millions of people on this planet, that no one has ever discovered an identical fingerprint. It's astonishing.
Now, as you live in London, you read the newspapers and the magazines. Do you squirrel away articles and stories and ideas that you might be able to use in your work?
No, I don't think I've ever... I used one real-life murder case indirectly in one book, in Innocent Blood. But on the whole, I don't seem to get ideas from papers or from real-life stories or from newspapers or from the television. It all starts with a place, and then it seems to come from my own imagination. But, of course, it's possible, in fact, I think it's very probable, in all the long years of my life, all sorts of odd little bits of information have been stored away and come popping up when I need them without me being able to, you know, identify the source.
Are you still a magistrate?
I am, because I think it's rather a sense of once a magistrate, you know, and having taken the oath you're a magistrate. But I don't, I'm on what's called the supplementary list. I don't sit in court because I was made a governor of the BBC, and that's so time-consuming.
I'm sorry, a what?
A governor of the BBC.
Uh-huh. That's like being on the board of directors?
That's it. Uh-huh. Mm. And that is so time-consuming, fascinating but time-consuming, that I had to give up something of my other obligations, so I gave up the bench. I would have had to stop anyway in August because I'm 70 then, and you don't sit after 70.
But that is probably a good source of ideas, isn't it?
Well, you don't actually meet atrocious murderers and rapists. At least you may be. You're just at the first court. You just decide whether there's a case to answer, and then they go on to the Crown Court to be tried. You see a great variety of ordinary crimes of life. I mean, over 90% of all crimes in the United Kingdom are tried by the magistrates in the lower court. And you see human beings and under stress, and you hear interesting stories. Everything is just to a novelist, I think, but I can't remember using the experience directly in a book.
What's England, and particularly London, like? I was talking to Margaret Drabble not too long ago, and she was complaining that there seems to be a growing feeling of violence and insecurity there.
Oh, I think that's true enough. I think London is more violent than it's ever been. But you see, the figures are not so bad. I mean, in the whole country we have fewer murders than you do in, say, Washington in a month. I think that's right. So the figures are not great, but the feeling is there. There is apprehension, there is a feeling, and I think it's probably true that certain parts of London you can no longer walk alone at night safely. And when I was a girl, I walked in London in the blackout during the war, in perfect safety anywhere. We do rather, you know, not exactly cringe, but put up our bolts and our bars and our alarm systems and feel much less secure, yes. There's much more mugging, for example, a great deal of street crime and street mugging in certain areas.
But Britain has not been belted by this drug epidemic, has it?
No, it hasn't yet. We're very worried about crack. And I think the police, you know, have a whole campaign to make sure it doesn't take hold. But, of course, it is a problem, undoubtedly. I don't, it's nothing like the problem you have here, but after all, we're all aware it could be.
That's why we have this violent and personal crime. I was called to serve as a juror not too long ago, and talking to the clerk of the court, and he was saying to me that 95% of all of the people brought into court for trial committed drug-related crimes.
It's appalling, isn't it? I would say back home there's quite a lot of alcohol-related crime. By that I mean, you know, there's quite a lot of assaults by people who just had too much to drink. Young men who've been to the pub and they've got into argument. And quite a lot of rapes, I think, are alcohol-related. Much, much less so drug-related. I don't think I saw a drug-related crime when I was a magistrate. But we are aware that, you know, it could happen, and it's terrifying.
Yes, it is, and it's usually said that it happens here first and then spreads.
Yes.
So I just hope
we are
that
well
you,
aware of that.
Yeah, set up strong border crossings.
Oh, we are trying to. We are trying to.
What's an average day like for you?
Well, this would depend very much, I think, on whether I'm writing a book or not. If I am, I'd get up early in the morning and try to do about 3 hours in the morning. Then, you know, have a fairly light lunch and then go out quickly and do some necessary shopping. Then there'd nearly always be interviews and a personal correspondence. I have a huge weight of correspondence. So I'd get that dictated for my secretary. Might have a quiet dinner with friends in the evening. But that's a free day. Most days there might be a meeting. The BBC governors, I have to leave the house by 8:15. I have a preliminary meeting at 9. That will go on all the morning. And that will include lunch afterwards. Then I might have a meeting with the British Council, the Royal Society of Literature, or the Arts Council. It's a very busy life.
No, it sounds busy. You must get a lot of fan mail.
Yes, a huge amount, yes.
Do you answer?
I try to. The difficulty is so many children write, and they're doing projects at school, you know, and I'm the writer, and you can't not reply to them. But it is, you know, it's very difficult. It's difficult to get any time to write. I think people don't honestly understand that there is only so much time in the day, and if you're trying to cope with 50 or 60 letters a day, then you're not going to be able to write books as well.
Don't you also have to be in the right frame of mind to write?
Yes, you do, to an extent, I think, Don. I mean, I think one can argue that a professional writer should always be in the right frame of mind, or should ignore the frame of mind, should sit down and say, I am going to write. I'm never quite sure, really, how far that works, because it seems to me that if you are not in the right frame of mind, if the words aren't flowing, if the inspiration isn't there, in a way you're almost wasting time. But then that might be an excuse for not doing it. I think perhaps one, at least I feel that when I'm writing a book, I ought to write every day. Perhaps not very much, but I ought to get up to that desk and sit down and write something every day. I think that I move into the world of the book. I move in with the people and their lives. And if I think, well, this isn't flowing, I'm a bit blocked here and put it away, then it all regresses. It's much better to stick at it.
But you spend more time on your writing, the actual development of good prose, than many genre writers. There's been a complaint. Everybody loves a mystery, but there's often a complaint from critics that while there's a good plot there, maybe an interesting character, the writing is kind of thrown off. Agatha Christie was always criticized because her writing was kind of awkward.
Yes, she wasn't a good writer. I wonder if I would say it was awkward. Pedestrian, flat maybe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Easy to read.
Yes.
Lots of dialogue which carries you along. But she was not a good novelist. Undoubtedly not. But then, you know, I sometimes feel, although I believe that profoundly, that it's really not a very kind thing to say, because she obviously gave so much pleasure to so many millions of people. You can't denigrate somebody who managed to do that. But I agree with you about mysteries. I think back home there are certainly some books published that I feel would not have found a publisher if they hadn't been mysteries. And I just can't read a mystery unless it's well written. I mean, the most important thing to me about a book is the writing. It's no good having fascinating characters if the writer can't describe them or can't make you see them or can't make you enter into their feelings, into their minds and into their lives. And to do that, you have to write well.
Well, you certainly do write well, P.D. James, and you have a big and admiring audience here in the States. And Devices and Desires, another hit from P.T. James. Thank you very much.
Thank you for talking to me, Don.